Blog Talk Radio.
Hello.
Good afternoon. This is Human Rights Demand. I'm a few moments late getting on the air. This is Mary Neal. I'm station director. Hello, Leona Brando. How are you?
Very well. How are you, Miss Neal?
Wonderful. Leona, I will leave it to you. This is New Vision Organization's president, Ms. Leona Brando. Go right ahead, Ms. Leona. You have two callers on the line, one from 1922 and the other from 3047. I want to welcome everyone to Human Rights Demand, where the guest call-in number is 347-857-3293. If any of you out in the radio audience would like to call in and be heard on air with your comments and questions, then you are invited to dial 347-857-3293. And this is Leona Brando, that's the president of New Vision Organization, who's on the line. I want you to know you just had another caller to call in at 3047. And I'm going to just leave everybody's lines live. So please, I ask you, if you're a guest on the line, to move yourself to a very quiet area, because any background noises could disturb and disrupt the entire radio broadcast. So thank you very much for calling in. And Leona, it's up to you.
Okay, I'd like to introduce today one of our guest speakers, which his name is Peter Vaughn, and Peter is one of the wrongfully convicted prisoners who will tell us a little bit about himself and also give us some insight into how things go when you are incarcerated, especially when you're in for a crime you did not commit. So, Peter, would you like to talk a little bit about yourself, how it came about that you ended up in prison, and some of the things that did go on?
Yes. Prior to being convicted, I was held on a $5,000 bail for robbing a supermarket in 83 as the outside lookout. And there was probably two others who were never charged with the crime. And, in fact, they never caught the real robber that I was supposed to be. So while sitting in jail and the robber on the escape, the old Charles Street, which is now Liberty Hotel next to Mass General, used to have a very, very bad environment.
Peter, could I just interrupt you for a minute? We have people that listen across the country, so if you can just let them know what state you're talking about right now.
Okay, Massachusetts, Boston, Massachusetts. I happened to be arrested for a crime I did commit, which was a B&E, a break and an entry, in the Back Bay. And while in jail, the second robbery happened up the Star Market by the same perpetrators. The photographic evidence won my case eventually, but during trial, my bail was reduced to maybe $100, $150, and I was out for that Thanksgiving and that holiday to go home and try to find someone at the NAACP and Attorney General Scott Hochberger's office at the time and tell him I'm going to court for a crime. Please help me. And nobody came, you know, to my rescue. After Thanksgiving, I went back to trial with a little more than $5 in my pocket to catch a train and subway and go to court like a good citizen. My bail was revoked. They locked me back up in jail. And 3 days after Christmas, after the trial, they convicted me and gave me 7 to 12 years Walpole. Prior to that release on the lower bail, I became violent. And I was 22, 23 years old at the time and did some isolation lockup. I mean, I had a breakdown of some sort, not with a drug problem, but a prior experience with drugs and recreational use before being arrested. And that's why I was probably breaking into the house the first time before I got blamed for the armed robbery. and they had me locked in the hole, as we call it. And, you know, in Charles Street, the jail was 100 years old, even in 83, where judges and advocates came in and wanted to see why it was such a bad environment. Well, there was rust coming down the walls from the roof where there was holes in the roof. There was rain. There were roaches. There were birds. There was mice. There was rats. And that jail was traumatizing, you know, for a lot of people out there who came up like I did. And let alone being in population where the phone calls were 10 cents, you got five dimes a day out of the canteen to make that many phone calls for 3 minutes for 10 cents. And if you got any more dimes than that to make a phone call and another inmate seen you taking a little bit more time than you should, he might have sucker punched you and you got locked up, you know, along with him. As far as the administrative lockup and 24-hour lockup, they still use that as an excuse to calm prison riots and to quell some of the riffraff going on where inmates are causing problems or have mental illnesses, and they don't address those. You know, they're just starting to come to light about those issues. Even in May 7th, Boston Globe, there's a Milton Wiener who did a story and talked about how the inmates are being segregated, you know, for simple things, because maybe they're interfering with the clique, you know, and the guards feel threatened that he might be hurt by others because that inmate is off, you know, he's not one of the pack. So
Peter, this is a very important issue you're talking about, because, and I want you to really expand on that, but I want to ask you, when you went to court, did they have, what kind of evidence did they have against you to actually?
Well, none. They had none. All they had was the photographic evidence. The people who picked me out of the lineup, supposedly a lineup of an array of photographs were shown. And the prison warden at Framingham, Lynn Bissonette, right now at the women's prison, worked at the Star Market in 83 in the courtesy booth where they were robbed of $38,000. Now, in 83, those people see me in court on an unrelated matter or at that time and pick me solely out of the bench myself. I went from robbing, from breaking into the house in 83, June 30th, 1983, I was arraigned in Roxbury Court where they lied and said they picked me out of a lineup. I'd never been in a lineup. I was the only one that afternoon when I was released from that six-month sentence on the B&E in court, and they said I was the robber. Now,
so you just happened to be in court. You just happened to be in court at the time when they pinned this other charge on you.
Yeah, they brought me in for arraignment. I had got the warrant while in Deer Island House of Correction for January 6th robbery. Mind you, the second one happened in March 83 while I was in jail on the B&E. And I got released from the B&E June 30th to Roxbury Court where I was the only one in the booth. There was no lineup. I remember it as clear as day where these three victims came in the court with the court prosecutor, the judge, and an attorney I had, William O'Hare at the time, said I was the one who robbed them. And all I can say is, hey, I didn't do it. You know, I'll be back to tell you the same thing. And they locked me back up in the Charles Street jail with a $5,000 bail. And
you were in for 3 years?
I did 3.5. I did 18 months in Charles Street and another 18. 522 days between jail. I went to Walpole. That night, probably 6 or 7 after, with all the other inmates from the jail, December 28th, 1984, and they put me in Walpole. They had a physical. They checked my knees, my unarms or whatever, and a physical by a doctor, and then they put me in this overcrowded unit, which was for Suffolk County in Boston, Massachusetts area, and they had Middlesex, and they had Essex County from people from different jurisdictions held in those blocks at the time. And I slept on a pool table. That's a ping pong table. It's with a mattress.
And these are the issues that we really want to talk about, because this, even though we have in every state the prisons, the Department of Corrections are operated differently, the problems, the issues of concern are all the same nationwide. And we're actually, this is how this radio show came about. We want to hear everything you went through. But right now, I want you to talk about how they finally came about to find out that you were not guilty.
Okay. Well, I appealed my case. My brother happened to be in prison for bank robbery at the time, who I found when I got convicted in Walpole, and then eventually transferred to Concord, the Norfolk State Prison, where I spent the rest of my time. Well, on appeal, the three judges in Dedham District Court and Appellate Court decided it was a rare decision to reverse my decision, acquit me, find an acquittal, because there was no way I could have done the robbery the second time if it was the same perpetrator who did the first one 2 weeks prior to the
shooting.
Prior
to, yeah.
And nobody ever said, why would Peter Vaughn be stealing a boombox, which it was, out of a window 2 weeks if he 2 weeks after if he robbed $38,000 January 673? Because I was arrested 2 weeks later. Didn't know nothing of it, didn't have $38, probably didn't have 38 cents. And I was breaking into the office, still a radio, and they had taken $38,330 that January 6th from the courtesy booth. And Lynn Bissonette, who's the prison warden at the Framingham State Prison, was one of the victims who came back in 2008 during my civil suit and said I was not the guy, you know, after 22 years. So.
Now, the people that accused you, that falsely accused you, did you ever get an apology from them?
No, an agreement was made by the Attorney General, Martha Coker's office, that if they were to apologize, I wouldn't get as much money. Those people, I don't know who they are. I don't remember what they look like or anything. I guess there were several who worked in the security booth. There was a security guard who was blind in one eye who wasn't sure if I did the robbery or not. But when they identified me, it was 6 months after the robbery, so they wasn't even sure. I know who the guy is, but he looks exactly like me to this day. And he's from Taunton, Massachusetts, and there's nothing they could do to him now because the statute of limitations of robbery was 10 years, and if you got away with it, you got away with it. After 10 years, if they never caught you.
And you're the one that served the time.
I served the time, and I found him there who admitted to doing the robbery. And my brother knew who the robber was at the time, but wasn't going to snitch. He was not going to tell to save his butt in prison while he was in for bank robbery to let his brother go free. And that's
now,
when I was up there at home.
Now, Mary, I wanted to mention this because I really had hoped to get a picture to you prior to the radio show today. But Peter is one of, was it 9, Peter, or 11 who were exonerated?
There's over 20, but in the photograph, there's about 9 of us in at the State House. The legislature passed a bill in 2004 that was retroactive and put a cap on the amount of money of up to $500,000 to expunge the record and pay up to 50% at a community college any time you're ready in your lifetime.
So there were 20 exonerated.
Over 20, yeah, 20.
In Massachusetts only.
So he was exonerated and he was compensated for his time spent in prison during a wrongful conviction. Is that right?
Right.
You know, the thing is, I felt really bad when I heard this, too, is that, as Peter mentioned, it was traumatic, and I want him to go more into this in a few minutes, but one of the things is, as Peter was telling me, and I want him to talk about this as well, there were 20 that were exonerated. There were 9 of them in the picture, and with the picture with the, was it the state senator and?
Senator Diane Wilkerson and Senator Pat. Diane Wilkerson from Roxbury and Pat J. Lynn from Somerville.
And I really would like to get this, Mary, if it's possible at all, to get this on picture on Facebook or get it on the video, because it will show the prisoners that were exonerated, of most of them of color, of course, but there was a few that weren't. But the thing is, these are some of the issues that we're facing in America today, the wrongful convictions, the trauma that goes with it, and what they experience. And, Peter, I would really love to have you speak more about, as you mentioned earlier, the solitary confinement, the trauma that you went through, you know, some of these things that really affected you. Because even if it was 1 month of this type of abuse, I see where a lot of the prisoners are suffering, and especially if there's some mental illnesses. And this is a major thing, because, first of all, I'm against solitary confinement anyway, especially long term. But if you can talk a little bit more about what you went through, the trauma that you went through, and everything that was going on, if you can talk a little bit about that, I'd like to hear that.
Well, I tell you. In Chelsea Jail, for example, I remember it like it was yesterday. Sometimes your legal mail is not supposed, or mostly all the time, your legal mail is not supposed to be open before they give it to you, if it comes from any attorney or any law practice. I guess some guys maybe not know, but probably most of the time do know they're not supposed to open your legal mail. And before they hand it to you, and I just got that picture, by the way, out of my files. They might not give you your canteen money in time or your canteen slip, which makes you miss a date to get your canteen, to buy deodorant, toothpaste, lotion, or whatever you need. They might not let you walk that hour a day, because by the way they do it, is lock you up for 23 hours, give you a shower every other day if you get a shower that day, and especially if you get in a fight with another inmate. Speaking of Aaron Hernandez's case, they know that you got a beef with somebody, but they still let you out because they want to get their jollies out for watching you get in more trouble or get in a fight. That wasn't fair to him.
And that's what happens. Yeah.
A lot of that happened with me. The guys I got in the fights with, they would let us both out at the same time. If they want to let you out at night to take a shower, they can do that. But if they want to let you out during the day, I'll alternate both of your days so you don't meet in the aisle or something, fine. But, you know, if they want to play games, they don't like you, they let you both out at the same time just to watch you fight. And now they're charging you with criminal cases. You know, there's been people who've been locked up who get in a fight, and they're taking them to court for it, you know. So,
So how long were you in solitary confinement?
I did a good part of the 18 months in jail in solitary confinement. Then after I got convicted to Walpole, they had a unit called the RB. I don't know what RB stands for, but that was another isolation block where a librarian would come by or person, another inmate who get books, and I can't remember how long I spent, you know, in that block before they released me to the modulars, which was...
So the RB is the restricted block you were on.
Yeah.
So you didn't have any opportunities to be...
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
and what...
I was in right back to lockup before I got the population, you know. And I don't understand what kind of evaluation that is. But, you know, as far as the 23-hour lockup goes, you know, because it's traumatized, people acquire mental illnesses if they're not already mentally ill. You know, and they're talking about that in May 7th Boston Globe. You know, how do you address that? I mean, half the crimes or most of the crimes committed by inmates before they get there are drug-related, you know, and alcohol-related.
Thank you for saying that. This is one of my passions is with the prisons are, as they say, mass incarcerations. Right now, the United States of America has the highest rates of incarcerations. We also have the highest highest human rights violations than any country in the world. And there are people now that are coming together, some really influential people that are coming together now to do something about it. But what's happening is, as you said, Peter, it's the prisons are full of mentally ill, and they're it's an epidemic, and they're full of addictions. And these, most of the crimes that are committed, whether they're nonviolent or violent, are committed when either as a result of substances or a result of mental illnesses or mental issues at the time. But I was going to ask if you can also talk about some of the others that were exonerated and what happened to some of them after they were released because of what they endured while incarcerated.
Yeah, Neil Miller, for example, received $2.3 million. As far as I know, he's still under the influence of substance. And he's a good friend, and I tried to help him. He's come to me for help. But, you know, in my doing around staying sober, you know, I got to look out for myself instead of going down with the others who asked me for help.
Right, and we don't want to mention their names, but we'd like to know exactly what happened to some of them, other than going back to or getting involved.
Yeah, Stephon Collins was murdered. I'm sorry about the name, but he's dead. I don't know. A lot of the numbers changed. I've lost contact with a number of them. One inmate who did 15 years. I received $5 million 3 weeks ago, and you might have seen in the Boston.
You mentioned one of them. But, one of them actually committed suicide.
No, that was the one that he attempted to.
Attempted suicide.
He cut his throat. He was charged with a rape, and he did 10 years. And he got in a fight with a lot of prison guards and. You know, because you're in for a rape case, you're not going to have much respect, like armed robbers and sticker boys and just typical drug addicts. You know, he got treated pretty bad.
Yes.
And he did over 2 or 3 years in solitary confinement. He came home in 2000, and right away, you know, like most of the inmates who were young and poor, went back to the same house, the same neighborhood where drugs were rampant anyway, and went on a tear with that and still got caught, like the one who got killed. You know,
this is really sad, too, because to be wrongfully convicted on a sexual assault, a rape charge, I can only imagine what he went through. And then to come out and not be able to adjust to all of that and to attempt to kill himself and everything. But these are things that are happening all over the country, again, like I say, and it's sad that it's happening. But when you were inside, Peter, did you have problems with the guards other than, you know, I'm sure you were really angry, too, being inside for a crime you didn't commit. And how did that affect you as far as dealing with the guards and the prison employees there?
Well, prior to getting convicted was where my problems really started, where I probably acquired the PTSD, as they call it now, other than diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder. The trauma from that preceded going to jail, you know, at the prison. When I was convicted, I was angry. I felt a little bit more at ease finally when I got to Norfolk because there was much more freedom, where most inmates from the streets would like to probably be because there's four baseball diamond fields, there's a garden, there's a basketball gym, there was weights at the time you can lift, there was boxing classes, there was a lot of that stuff that is no longer there. And, you know, having a little freedom to do what I want, you know, in given times in my cell wasn't locked. You know, they did construction in the prison. They put cages and steps and paint. You know, I don't think I had problems with guards in prison. I think it because my brother probably kept me mostly in line at the time. But, prior to being in jail in Charles Street was a little insane, you know.
Were you ever able to actually work on your case while incarcerated or just didn't have the knowledge to do it?
Well, I mean, there's a prison library. No one came to visit. Rarely did my mother like going to visit me. Nobody wants this guy to be known about that he did the robbery. So I was, you know, basically told to just keep my mouth shut and not say a word about the real robber. My brother, who had resources in the library, who was there for some time, helped me appeal my case, and I looked up a few, and you know, I didn't know when I was getting out originally. I didn't know when my appeal was going to be heard. You know, the day they told me I was being released was after I went to Bridgewater State Hospital for threatening to murder another inmate, and then get sent back to Norfolk State Prison in a whole different unit. My old cell was gone, and they told me to pack up. I was going home. And I went before the Superior Court downtown Boston, where my mother met me in the courtroom, and they told me I had a warrant for my arrest. Don't say anything when you go before this panel. And they told me I was free to go home. I was being acquitted. And I walked and caught a cab with my mother and went to see my son, who's now deceased, who died hanging in prison. And I actually started drinking and doing drugs for 8 years. From then on, now I'm working on 20 years sober come November 2nd, 94.
Wow.
And go to the detoxes. I speak at the detox twice a month. I see all the young girls from 18 and up, and women and men, and try to share a message of hope and recovery and how you can be at peace and not be angry all your life, you know, over trauma, and always doing the next right thing to stay out of trouble and ahead of the law.
You know, we're really proud of you, Peter, because a lot of men that go through that, they don't come out and try as hard as you have been doing, and doing the right things, and, you know, trying to help others through it all, and losing your son to suicide. You've really gone through an awful lot, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on the radio show, because you are one of the unique ones who, there's been so many who have gone in for wrongful convictions, and even those who haven't gone in for wrongful convictions, mm-hmm. who have gone in for any kind of crime, have gone through so much trauma because, as a first offense or whatever, going into prison, and the way the prisons are run, they're not run to operated to rehabilitate people. They may have the programs, the funding for the programs available, but they don't provide the treatment that they should. And it's affected so many people across the country. And I just feel like you being able to come out, and I know that it prevented you from even progressing more, because I'm sure with your personality that you could have gone a lot further had you not been spending those 3 years in prison on a wrongful conviction.
Right.
But at the same time, you came out and you're trying to help others by telling your story, you know, by trying to help them in other ways to prevent going in the first place.
Right. And tonight... Yeah, I used a regular day, routine day. You know, I spend babysitting my granddaughter some time, who's 3 years old, and she's got a cousin who's 3 years, and they got another baby who's 7 months. And I have much respect for other people. And people give me their car today, you know, to take their kids to school, drop them off. You know, I have a good life. You know, I'm enjoying it. You know, I'm going to be 53 this month, and, you know, it's too late to stop trying to run from the cops now, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't do anything out of way. I always try to do the next best thing and say my prayers and ask for guidance. Well, God, I couldn't do none of this, you know.
Amen.
I'll be in Fairhaven at a meeting tonight and just sharing. Hopefully somebody gets the message. And usually after I step down from the podium, when the meeting's over or during break, someone says, I like your story, I understand what you have to say, and some people want to talk and ask me how I do it. And I say, with God's help, you know, there's no other way.
Now, how old were you when this happened?
21.
21 years old.
20, I got out 25, 26 years old. I moved to Brockton, Massachusetts. I've been here 27 years. And the police are old enough to be my child, my kid. So.
Yeah. You know, have you ever thought about going into, and this is something we're talking about with the organization, trying to get the prisoners, when they come out, especially the wrongfully convicted, or those who have been abused, to actually go around to the universities and to the, you know, the colleges around the country, actually, to talk about some of these things and to talk about the experiences. Because, first of all, we need people. We need volunteers. We need people to join forces and try to advocate for the incarcerated men, women, and youth across the country. And we also need to give a message, bring a message to those that are going to school for law, you know, to work with, you know, criminal and appellate cases.
You're a great source of information. You know, there's not many ways you can get this out without help like you. You know, you're doing good, and I'm proud of you. I've known you for several years, and I appreciate you calling me to come on the show. And it relieves me of some of the daily thoughts I have about my past and stuff. You know, and I don't try to go there all the time, because my head is like the project, it's a bad neighborhood, so I try to stay out of it by saying my prayers and helping others, you know, and clean house, you know. And I've got my mom who turned 87 yesterday, and she don't look for anything for me to get in trouble for. She knows I'm doing well.
Yeah.
And I've got to help a lot of people. I mean, I got compensated $275,000. When does anybody get that? And save it, you know, the first time they have that kind of money. I don't have much, but I have a lot, you know.
The thing is, even with the money, it doesn't take back what you've lost, you know, the youth, your young youthful life and everything. It's gone. Yeah. You can never take it back. But I actually think, though, that if more people like yourself, you know, to do what to go through what you've gone through, and then maybe coming together in unity to start making a big change by going. We have right now, we're in the process, our attorney that works with us from New York, Anchor Jane, Vice President William Grigsby, they're actually planning on doing some public relations work and doing some media coverage over these abuses. I don't know if you've heard about the prisoner from Florida that was scalded to death. He was locked in a stall by guards, and they turned the water up to 180 degrees, and they scalded him alive until his skin came off of his body. And the prisoners on the block were hearing him screaming for his life, begging for his life. And they scalded him to death. There was a prisoner that they baked in New York in the prison cell. They turned the heat way up, and he ended up baking to death. They had a prisoner in Colorado who they chained to a chair, and he was having seizures while he was in the chair, and he ended up dying while the guards were laughing. There was a scalding in California, and there was a girl that was beaten to the point where her teeth were all broken. These are things that are happening across the country, and it's getting worse. It's getting worse, and now they're planning on bringing this to the public. But we'd like to get people, prisoners like yourself and others, who are able to go out there and talk, maybe when they meet with the press, to talk about the issues that you have gone through, the wrongful convictions, the mental illnesses, the addictions, and the things that you have gone through in the prisons, including the solitary confinement. And I don't know if you'd be interested, and if you are, just at some point in time, give me a call and we can talk more about it.
I'll give you a number. I will.
And we want to get the ones that have come out, that have a voice right now, to join forces with us so that we can actually start making a difference.
Yeah, I have one friend in Boston who served 3 years for a murder. He was convicted, and then he was found not guilty at a second trial where the social worker was murdered, walking a person with Down syndrome, and her pocketbook was snatched, and she went to go after her pocketbook, and she was murdered. But they used the Down syndrome person to testify at the trial and could not pick the defendant, and he was still convicted. You know, he served 3.5 years himself.
And was it the DNA that released
him? No, misidentification. It was a number of things where whites didn't get along with blacks too well at that time in that area of the neighborhood, and there was teenage white boys that seen someone with a blue coat run up the street selling, and the cop says, well, you got a blue coat, so it must be you. But the kid had asthma at the time. He couldn't run as far as they said he did, where he got to the point where they arrested him. So he did 3 years. He got acquitted in the second trial, and he got compensated also.
Jeez.
So
I heard something recently too that Mary, I don't know if you had mentioned this, but they about the accusations prior to confirmation of guilt. They had talked about, this is what they're talking about doing now, is if they see someone that they think is capable of committing a crime, or if they think the person may have committed the crime, they're going to actually stop them.
Yes, Leona. Last week, I broadcast the fact that in Arizona, and this is happening other places, that they have a program where they are doing essentially lunacy detainments. People who have documented cases of mental illness, or they have complaints from their families or neighbors about mental health crises, and they are picking these people up in the absence of crime and supposedly taking them to psychiatric facilities or treatment. I think that can be good, and it can be seriously abused.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought the public needs to know about it. The reason I think it's good is because since mental health care has been in the hands of the Department of Justice and treated as a crime, the Department of Justice and crimes have to await a crime before they can actually move in and do anything. So that is very bad for community safety. It's certainly very bad for the victim's family. It's bad for the community. For mental health care to be in the hands of Department of Justice requires them to await a crime. So I think that doing something before crimes happen is very good. On the other hand, we know that that can be abused, because we have an example when a New York police officer reported corruption in the NYPD. He was, his supervisors apparently sent police officers to drag him out of this apartment and take him to a psychiatric facility or the psychiatric ward of a jail on the supposition that he must be crazy to report corruption in the NYPD. So for that, we can see how giving corrupt officials the opportunity to call a person mentally ill and go get them and detain them on that basis, how easily it can be
misconstrued. Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. It can be misused because those people who are detained are not necessarily mentally ill. We also have an example from Facebook where this gentleman who was an ex-military man was writing on Facebook about his I think he disagreed with war. He disagreed with aggression, military aggression. And he was also arrested and detained in, I think, a psychiatric facility because he was voicing his opinion against American military aggression. So those are two examples of how the right to arrest people pre-crime, they call it pre-crime detainment, can be misused by people who are in power simply to make people shut up, or simply to ridicule or what they say, you know, because if a person has a history of being detained in mental hospitals and what have you, that destroys their credibility somewhat. So I think that, you know, we have to be very careful about pre-crime detainment, even though we need someone credible to have that power to actually stop crimes before they happen. Because this one woman who was picked up in Arizona was allegedly sitting outside, butt naked, and she had been talking about suicide. So obviously she had a problem going on, and why would authorities wait until she does commit suicide? So it's really a dilemma for the public. I think that these the ability to detain a person pre-crime is something that's going to have to be very carefully monitored by individuals who are who have a great deal of credibility. And so I would just caution the public on that. I'm not against it, certainly not against it, because it's needed. We need someone to be able to address mental illness pre-crime. I think everybody can agree with that. But,
you know,
we also need strong protections for whistleblowers and others, because they are liable to be subject to these pre-crime arrests just because they're whistleblowers. And I thank you for listening.
And there are guests. Actually, there are whistleblowers who are not in prison, but they're in politics, and their lives are a danger when they do report things that are happening in certain areas. I think that you're right, Mary. I think they need to have protection. They need to have some kind of a law that protects them, because there's a lot of them out there that are wanting to talk about it, wanting to get it out, tell the truth about it, let it be known, and at the same time, they fear for their lives. But I notice more and more people are coming out to talk about these issues that are going on, because even with the prisoners, they say they're going to be abused anyway. They're going to be tortured anyway, so they might as well do it while trying to get help. And a lot of them now are actually talking about the issues that are going on in the prisons. We have a prisoner that we have been working with who came out of the military with the Purple Heart, and he worked for the CIA or the FBI in New York, and he tried to expose his peers for the drugs, the things that were going on in his department, and he ended up getting set up, and he ended up going to prison. So a lot of them that want to try to do something about these things are being penalized for getting the word out. And
well,
these are issues that need
right,
to be.
Brianna, because I had a radio program host named Mr. Brett Mosley, and he objected to prisoner abuse that was happening in the DOC down there in Mississippi. And he objected to the prisoner abuse, and they, according to him, tried to set him up on drugs. And I think that's the usual setup they choose for black men. And he has on Facebook a site called DOC Drug Setup, Mississippi DOC Drug Setup or something similar. And so also in Memphis, I received a call from Memphis, someone who used to work for the Memphis Shelby County Jail, where my brother was secretly arrested in 2003 for 18 days and murdered. This former Shelby County guard told me that he could not give me specific information regarding Larry Neal's murder. That's my brother's name, Larry Neal, N-E-A-L. He said, though, that he could tell me how they have killed mentally ill subjects in that jail, and he described something regarding the gladiator killings and gladiator abuse that was happening this year in Florida. And so I knew already that guards were using mentally ill subjects in prison for gladiator sports, because I learned it from a guard in Memphis Shelby County Jail years ago when he called me to help me to try to have some information as to how the mentally ill were treated in that correctional facility. And so he said that when he refused to go along with a concocted tale as to how a particular mentally ill inmate died, the mentally ill inmate, according to him, had been one of the gladiator subjects. He was a little guy, sort of effeminate. he had been let out of his cell, and also a great big guy had also been let out of his cell, and they're not supposed to be out together. And the big guy had attacked the little guy and beat him to death, but the guy didn't die right away. At the end of the sporting event, they threw the little effeminate guy back in his cell to die, and this guard happened to come on shift early in the morning, and it was before the young man had died, and the young man was able to tell him exactly what happened to him. And so this man refused to go along with the jail's version that this man had died by slipping on soap in the shower. And therefore, Mr. Gregory's family was able to get a settlement for wrongful death. However, what happened to the guard who told that it was gladiator sports going on is that sometime shortly thereafter, he was set up on drugs. He was set up for drugs. And the tale is interesting because they got some inmates there at Memphis Shelby County Jail, according to him, to say that he was bringing in drugs and selling them to the inmates. But one of the young men who was supposed to testify against him later called him at his home and told him about why he was doing that, that he really didn't want to falsely testify against him, and that he knew that he had never sold drugs and that he wasn't going to do it. He was not going to falsely implicate this guard for drugs because he appreciated this man telling about Mr. Gregory's murder, and he refused to do it. He had changed his mind. This was a young man, about 19. Well, the young man who refused or who said he was going to withdraw his agreement to testify against the former guard, he came up dead. And the person who killed him came up dead. And so it looked like one of those JFK things where first this assassin got killed and then the one who, first he got killed and then his assassin got killed. So it was rather involved. And so this guard, when he went to trial and they arrested him in broad daylight on live camera and his name was ruined in the community. His name was ruined with all of his coworkers at work and at his church. I mean, they really destroyed him by taking him out of the jail on camera and saying that he was being arrested for selling drugs to the inmates. But he complained because they had his trial in night. You know, they did all of that in broad daylight, but they gave him a night date for trial. And he said when he got to trial, they simply dismissed the charges. So what they did was, you know, they dismissed the charges, and the judge also ordered that he should be given his job back. But Shelby County Jail, to show you the power of these jails and prisons, Shelby County Jail never did give this man his job back, which was in direct violation of the court's order, according to this gentleman. And so these jails and prisons have a lot of power, and so do police departments. And I'm told it's union power that they have.
Exactly.
But I think it's something more. I think it's actually blackmail power that they have. You can imagine that jails, prisons, and police departments have much information on some of these judges, some of these people in politics. They have a great deal of information, but whether you know it or not, police departments have some of the same technology that NSA, the National Security Agency, has to monitor phone calls and to use GPS to see where people go. So they have as much capability as NSA, some of them, to monitor people. And if you monitor, I think, the average politician and their family, you might be able to pick up some dirt. So I think that that's one way, you know, people always wonder how the police get away with all of these murders and all of this brutality, and none of them are ever prosecuted, or if they are, they're usually released and what have you. I think that generally speaking, they're using blackmail against the system, against people whose job it is to justice. Thank you very much. Please continue.
I agree in a way. It sounds like it's very possible, plausible, but it's almost like someone has to, and it can't be just one person. It takes everyone, advocates in unity, to be able to overcome these things. Prisoners don't bring in the drugs, nor do some of the good guys. But unfortunately, you're right, Mary. The ones that are bringing in the drugs are the staff themselves, are the guards themselves. Maybe not in the case of this particular guard, but the guards to me, and I believe this because it's happened in Massachusetts where they caught guards bringing it in, but yet they talk about bringing the dogs in and doing all these things to make sure that drugs don't get in the system.
Well, we know that drugs and also the cell phones and generally any paraphernalia, even weapons, are brought in by the guards. We have a caller at 4257. I'd like to have an opportunity to speak, if it's okay with you, Leona.
Yes, it is.
Hi,
okay,
Leona.
4257, would you like to, do you have a question or comment?
Hello?
4257.
Hello,
Leona?
Hello? Yes.
Hi, it's Bill.
Hi, yeah. Bill, how are you?
I'm just wonderful. I haven't gotten to hear, listen to any of the radio show. I just got off the phone with the executive director, Dr. Russell Meyer, of the Florida Council of Churches, about the young man who was scalded to death in Florida. So I do apologize for my latency.
How did that go?
So you just talked to the National Council of Churches?
The Florida Council of Churches signed a letter in pact with the ACLU of Florida, along with some other organizations, to try and strike up a federal investigation into that case where the inmate was scalded. In the showers. And he's actually going to send me some more detailed information about the case that wasn't released, so that we could include that in our press release.
Wonderful news. I want to just say real quickly, and then, I'll let y'all go ahead and talk. I want to say real quickly regarding the man who was scalded to death in the showers, who was so badly burnt that his meat separated from his muscle, that the guards that are clearly seen on camera dragging this inmate into the small shower, the guards were released. I mean, they were not prosecuted. It was said that there wasn't enough evidence. Now, how much evidence do you need? You got the people clearly on film dragging this man who's kicking and screaming and protesting into the shower. And so now we have the ACLU and the Council of Churches in Florida who are asking for a federal investigation of this murder. And I just want to fill everybody in on what happens after correctional facilities are given federal investigations, because, see, you know, the public cheers when correctional facilities that have done murders are given federal investigations. We breathe a sigh of relief and we feel like mission accomplished, but that's not the case. My brother, Larry Neal, and you can look that up online, wrongful death of Larry Neal, he was in a facility, Memphis Shelby County Jail, that had already been investigated and found to be in violation of the U.S. constitutional rights of their inmates. So what happens is that when the feds investigate, they're looking for a pattern of abuse, and if they find a pattern of abuse, they then put that particular correctional facility under agreement with the USA to make specific changes in their daily operations to guarantee the safety of the inmates. So Memphis Shelby County Jail had an agreement with the USA to make certain adjustments in their daily operations to guarantee the safety of the inmates in that correctional facility. My brother was later, after the agreement had been signed, my brother was secretly arrested there. And every time we called or a social worker called, they'd lie and say he was not in custody. But they did nothing to help us find the mentally ill heart patient, Larry Neal, because they knew they had him in custody. You can be assured that people know who they have in custody because, number one, the first thing a person gets when they go into custody is their fingerprints taken. And there are no two people with the same fingerprints. So that kind of just shoots that lie to hell. And secondly, Larry Neal was a frequent flyer in that jail. In fact, he had been arrested just 2 weeks prior to his fatal arrest. And so they definitely knew they had him in custody. But whatever they were doing to him during those 18 days, and I'm not sure whether he was used for waterboarding training, whether he was tortured for science, whether he was tasered to death or beaten to death or starved to death. These are all things that have happened, by the way, to American inmates. I'm not sure how they killed him because they won't say. But in any case, this jail was already placed under overview by the USDOJ. They were already operating under the terms of an agreement with the USA. So all of that you're saying that people are trying to get done in Florida had already been done in Memphis Shelby County Jail. And nevertheless, they secretly arrested and murdered my mentally ill brother. And what happened is that the United States Department of Justice then colluded with Memphis Shelby County Jail officials to help cover up the murder. So I want you to know that people, when we say we want the USA or the USDOJ to do an investigation, what we're still saying is that we want police to investigate police. It doesn't really matter so much as you would hope that some are federal police and some are local police, because generally speaking, the USDOJ investigations are done by local people. In other words, I talked to Mr. Britton Mosley about the situation, and he said that the USDOJ officials, like the FBI, who do investigations of facilities in Florida, or in Tennessee, or in Mississippi, are local people. They don't send them out of Washington or someplace else. They just call the local FBI office and say, we want you to do an investigation. So these are their comrades. These police officers and jail wardens and whatever are their comrades. They are their neighbors. They name each other's children after each other. They date each other's wives. And so now you want this FBI agent who was just over to the warden's house for lunch to investigate this prison. And so you run into situations like that. So even though, you know, we have a separation in our mind between the federal police and the local authorities, there is really no such separation in their minds. So they will lie for them, they will trick for them, and they will cover up murders, and that's what they did regarding the secret arrest and wrongful death of Larry Neal. And you can look that up online, wrongful death of Larry Neal. Thank you very much.
And Mary, one of the things that I wanted to say real quickly is, and I agree with you, but I just realized that the new attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice, Jocelyn Samuels, I actually believe that she's trying to do the right thing. Unfortunately, not everyone in the DOJ is going to be honest enough. But I believe this woman is honest enough to know that she's trying to do something with all of these things going on in the prisons, because since she's been on, and she actually had someone respond to me when I needed help. And although they didn't give me the help, she did have them give me some contact information of someone I could contact. But the problem we have with the DLC, and I say this about the government in general, I believe that we have two governments in this country. I still believe that. I believe that there's a lot of things going on that our government doesn't even know about because other people in the government are deceptive. The problem with the whole thing is proving it, for one thing.
Well, Leona, could I interject? I know you say that, you've said that before, and you really believe that, but because, you know, you got people in the federal government that you want to admire. So you say that you believe that there's a separate government, a government, and what have you. I submit to you that that idea has already been disproved by Edward Snowden in his revelations regarding NSA. They know every phone call, every email, whether it's cell phones or land phones. They know every communication that all people in America have made, at least for the last 20 years. So there is no chance that the federal government does not know what's going on. They know who murdered who. They know who's selling dope to who. They know who's banging who. They know everything about everyone, according to the information that they've even admitted that they're collecting emails and they're collecting photographs of everybody. So there is no shadow government. There's only one government, and they know what stuff it is that they want to know. So there's no shadow government. There's no second government. There's no shadowy creatures someplace hiding, and they know more than the people who are in office. No. They're all fully aware of whatever it is that's going on. So and if they're high enough up, they're fully responsible for whatever it is that's going on. But what I think we have here with all of this spying is we've got people who are captured. They are essentially being blackmailed by their own past deeds. I think that is what we're looking at. Not necessarily that they don't know what's going on, but that they feel like their hands are tied because all of them may have something in their own background or some close relative that it would be tremendously damaging if it was brought out. So they can all be blackmailed. And that is the biggest danger of this secret spying program that America has, is that it precludes any of us from being able to have a public officials who are not blackmailed. So if you can blackmail public officials, then you can command them to vote the way you want them to on any given bill or any given circumstance. You are in control and not them, because they have lost their autonomy due to their own problems or due to the problems of someone very close to them. I'll give you an example, and I'm not saying this man was blackmailed. I'm just saying here's an example. This man who was kicked out of office after it was revealed that he was dating on his wife. You know, that hadn't been that long ago. He lost his position because he was dating on his wife. There's another man in New York who lost his position as a candidate. I believe he was running for mayor because he was sending naked pictures through his cell phone. And, of course, anything you send through cell phone is into their hands. And so these are examples how careers can be destroyed if certain information that you send through cell phones or computers, it can be released. So those are just two examples. So what I'm saying is, I'm saying that probably everybody who is in office, there is a file on them, and somewhere in there may be some information that they don't want disclosed. Thank you very much.
Would you be agreeable to this, that when we have advocacy, and I think I mentioned this before, advocates across the country, would you believe that all of these advocates are actually advocating, or would you believe that a lot of these advocates, or some of them, may be doing it just to get information, just to share information?
No, I don't think so. I think that they have technology to get information. And in SA, for instance, has over 50,000 employees, and they also have any number of contract employees. And so I submit to you that they don't anymore need those individual COINTELPRO agents like they used to have in the 60s and 70s. They're no longer needed because, generally speaking, everyone communicates through the Internet, whether it's Internet telephones or Internet cell phones or Internet computers. And so, therefore, they don't need all of those in-person agents that they used to use. That's old. That's bygone. But what I think they do is they still use some COINTELPRO agents, and their job is more sinister than simply to listen and carry back information. They're not needed for that. They're used to what they're used for is for disrupting effectiveness. And so their job is to get in there in these organizations and disrupt the effectiveness of the organization. That's what I think.
Okay. And I think that could be, yeah, that makes sense. That does make sense.
Yes. So for instance, have a COINTELPRO agent working right next to you, and you know, I call you, and instead of Leona Brando answering the phone, this agent answers the phone that you don't know is an agent, and I have to go through her or him and ask him to have you call me instead of the phone ringing directly to you, then you probably would not learn that I even called you. So this is what I think, this is where a lot of failure comes in, because a great many of the people who are in these organizations, and this is not grassroots organizations, because generally grassroots organizations don't have personal assistance. We don't have the budgets for it. But I think that it's a big problem in the bigger human and civil rights organizations. We may say, well, I wrote to this group, I wrote to this organization, but the executive director, did he get your message? Or does he have a personal assistant who may be a COINTELPRO agent whose job it is to go through messages and weed out yours? So these are all problems that we have living in a society that is controlled by individuals who are very corrupt and whose job seems to be destroying personal liberty and the quest for personal liberty from African Americans with particularity.
Mm-hmm. But okay, in this case here with what Bill's saying, though, this to me, this is something that even though you think that the Department of Justice won't do anything with, wouldn't you agree, though, that it would be worth a shot for everyone, for all advocates, to actually come together and make it a point to do it? I mean, I realize we're talking about going to the World Court and everything with these human rights issues, but at the same time, in the meantime, I should say, it would be good if we could do something on a national level with advocates, with influential people that might be able to at least force them into doing an investigation that should make sense. These men that committed this crime by now should have been charged. They should have been, because it's not a matter of did they do it, because everyone knows they did it. I mean, a man was scalded to death. I mean, he didn't do it to himself. So, you know, these are the things that need to be done, and they should have been charged by now. In the meantime,
well, you know, we can just assess some other mass efforts to see whether or not a mass effort would really matter. The largest justice quest that I know about in the history of America was the justice quest to save Troy Davis. His petitions had over 600,000 signatures, and his signatories included dignitaries from America and other countries. For instance,
Tookie Williams too.
Was one of his signatories. Bishop Tutu was one of his signatories. I think even the Pope signed. And so all of these tremendous voices spoke against the execution of Troy Davis, along with 600,000, at least 600,000 people who were officials all the way down to regular people like you and me. And so none of that saved Troy Davis. So we can just use that as an example of how much attention the justice system pays to public outcry. They have really decided that they don't care about whether we like what they do or not. Even when we make it known that we don't like inmates being soldered to death, even when we make it known that we don't like the idea of mentally ill heart patients being secretly arrested and murdered, they simply don't care. And the reason they don't care is because I think that in their own mind, they have gotten so much power now that they no longer have to be concerned about what the average American or certainly foreign dignitaries think about them. And when people perceive in their own mind that they are above the law, above reproach, then generally something is giving them that sense of being indestructible. And I think that what is happening and what we're observing is the results of electronic voting. I think that they're no longer afraid of losing their offices because the people can vote them out of office. Because the truth is that those voting machines vote for whoever in the hell they want to, and they put whoever in office that they want to. And so, you know, we always say, well, go vote them out. But I don't think you can vote out anybody that the system wants in there because of this electronic voting. And it's electronic voting that has no way of recount because nobody has a receipt. So if you want to get power back to the people, you have to start at the voting machines. I think that those voting machines can do what any adding machine can do. Any adding machine is able to make you a copy of your receipt. And if you put the white paper and the yellow paper, it can make two copies of your receipt. So if everybody went and voted, and then you got a receipt of who you voted for, and you had a chance to look it over and make sure that it was correct. And then if you dropped one, the white copy in the Democrat box, and you dropped the yellow copy in the Republican box, and you dropped another copy in the electoral, the local elected, the people who count the votes box, so you got three-part copies, then if a person wanted a recall, they would be able to count the votes. But see, we have no way of recall, and I want to remind everybody that Jimmy Carter, the reason he won as governor of Georgia all those years ago is by recall. They didn't really give him his election. He won it by recount. If he had had no way, like we don't now, of recounting the votes, he would never have gotten very far in his political career because they had cheated him out of that gubernatorial election. So the thing is that these people don't care what we like or don't like. They don't pay any attention to our petitions. They don't give a hang because we have no power. Because when we lost the power of voting,
I'd like to interrupt you, Mary. You know, I understand your viewpoints, and I really do, but I have to interject here. We're getting completely off topic, but just to put my own little stipend in there, I don't agree with what you're saying about the electoral voting, and this is the reason why, because I work and I see how it's conducted. And there is a receipt printed from each machine that tallies each individual vote. But that's not even the bottom line. The bottom line is that what you're saying, I'm not saying that what you're saying is not true. I'm just simply stating that at this point you're saying there's no way to go back and recount votes. But let me just make you aware of something. If the power to these politicians is there, that they can get in because there's some form of a system working behind here, and, you know, that they want these people voted in, they don't want them voted out, et cetera. What makes you think that even back in the day where we counted ballots, personal electoral presidents of each county and each state government who submitted their count then fudge numbers themselves to see who they personally wanted? And that's very, it's very easy for it to have happened even back then in the day. So really the issue of the voting, the fraudulent, the issue of the fraudulent
elections are nothing new, but it's just that it's easier now with electronic voting. They're not
sure.
New. I pointed out to you that Jimmy Carter was the only way he won his gubernatorial election was through a recount. So fraudulent elections are nothing new, but they're easier with electronic voting.
You know what? You're right. And the same thing happened with the recount for President Bush. So I'm not disagreeing with you. What I'm saying is that's not the issue here. And I don't agree with the issue of what your previous statement was about these federal investigations, because if what you're saying is 100% true on every single case, then what's the point of doing this? What's the point of being an advocate?
Well, exactly.
Because what you're saying is that we're
you're
not making a difference.
What is the point? The point is
but
that
I don't
people,
believe that. I believe that we are making a difference.
It's fine for you
I've
not to
it.
Believe it, sir, but I got a dead brother that these people killed, and they will not give me any information on it, and you tell me what is democratic about that. It's fine for you not to believe it, but I've got a grave in Tennessee that proves it. So it's fine for you to choose to believe or not believe what I say, but I don't ask anybody to believe me because I've got proof of everything I say. So these people are doing their own thing. Troy Anthony Davis was executed despite 600,000 signatures, including dignitaries from all over the world, so they are acting in disregard of what the public thinks. So this conversation started out because Leona Brando asked, what did I think? She asked, what did I think about people getting together and coming together and demanding a redress of grievances regarding the young man who was scalded to death. So I was just reminding her that they don't really care about people coming together and protesting. And I gave specific examples, and that being that the largest effort to get together on behalf of an inmate was the Troy Davis effort, and it failed. So that is a matter of history. It's not something that depends on whether or not you believe it. It's a matter of historical record. That
and it's
man
not
is
only,
murdered in spite.
It's not only Troy Davis either. It was Tukey Williams, another situation. But the thing is, Mary, I was going to mention too, Sherry Sweeney, her husband, Patrick, also died in prison, and she tried to get his medical records too, and they didn't give it to her. So you're right as far as that go. And I don't understand why the government, the United States Department of Justice, they don't ensure that when people want those records that they get them, because no one, and her husband was mysterious death too, not as severe as with Larry. And I'll tell you another thing. If that were me, I probably would feel the same way you felt or feel, because your brother, as you said, he didn't commit a crime. It was a simple situation where everyone was trying to find him. He disappears, and you contacted the police. You contacted all these places, and they said they hadn't seen him. And then all of a sudden he shows up, and he's, you know, they claim that he died of, was a heart attack, and then to find bruises on him. And it's just the not knowing that would I can actually understand. It's just the not knowing what happened to your brother. And the Department of Justice, they have not made it easy for you, because they could have gotten those records easily. The problem with the United States Department of Justice is there is a lot of corruption there. There's a lot of things that I, to myself, I don't even understand with the Department of Justice. But what I'm saying is we need to find out, we need to do something about it because, and I'll tell you, as far as voting, again, I don't vote because I'll tell you, no matter who you get in, I voted for the people I thought was going to make a difference this time around, and they never did anything. And that goes for the president and our governor right here in Massachusetts. They talk a good game. They don't do anything. And they all stick together. And I used to feel bad because I used to feel like everybody was preventing our president from moving forward. But I sometimes wonder. We can't, and I tell even with volunteer, with the advocates across the country, we cannot please everyone and we cannot serve two masters. And we have advocates that in this country that are afraid to step on toes. I've stepped on toes and I haven't became too, I'm not too well liked by the NAACP and by others because I speak my piece. But the thing is, if we don't do anything, if we don't even try to do something, then we might as well say we're no better than anybody else out there that claims to be advocates. And another thing, I just recently got into it. I didn't get into it. She got into it with me, was an advocate who was calling, was saying that she was defending another advocate. If an advocate can't defend herself, then how in the hell is she going to defend a prisoner? And this is what gets me, too, because these advocates that claim that they want to do the right thing and they claim to be so big and bad, but yet they cannot come to another advocate and let that other advocate know when they got a problem with them. So I don't know how true this advocate, Donna Fender, or Donna Hill now.
Leona, if I could, you know, just clarify this, and then I will let y'all go on with your show. I appreciate everybody speaking and everybody, you know, giving their opinions, and we want to invite other opinions on this. The phone number is 347-857-3293, and we have another 33 minutes on air. So if you would like to call and give your opinion on what can be done to improve justice in America, please call 347-857-3293. And I just want to clarify that I'm not saying to anyone that nothing can be done. If nothing could be done, then we're all wasting our time. But I think it's important to start at the real problem. I don't start in the middle. I don't start at the end. The end result is that prisoners are being killed. We all see
exactly
the end result. And the middle result is that the USDOJ is not doing its job to protect the rights of institutionalized people. That is not something we ask them to do as a favor. That is something they're paid to do out of our taxes. So when they ignore these murders and this brutality, then they are getting paid out of fraud, because when you accept payment, your salary, for doing a certain thing and you don't do it, then you're guilty of fraud and racketeering. So that isn't even the beginning of the problem. The problem begins when Americans lost their right to vote. And what we did is we lost our right to vote when we lost our ability to do independent recounts. So I thank you very much. As far as those machines tallying all the votes that's in it, that, again, is up to the machine, because I don't have to. Nobody has to believe me. You can read about people who were casting their vote for one individual, and it would change in front of their eyes to another individual that they did not vote for. So when they lost their right to be able to tally those votes, when the person lost his individual right to be able to look over his sheet and know that he voted for who he voted for, to know that his vote went to the person that he was voting for, when that individual voter lost that right, then we lost the whole ball game. And it's very easy for us to get that right back. All we have to do is demand that the voting machines give three-part receipts, one for each major political party, and one for the local election commission. That would solve the whole thing, and then that would put voting back in the hands of the people. So I thank you very much.
We just found out recently, didn't we? Wasn't it in the news not too long ago where they were they were using dead people for votes. They were actually counting the deceased votes in a lot of these states.
Yes.
That was unbelievable. But the thing is, I don't think there's any accurate way, efficient way for anybody to monitor the voting system. I just don't.
Well,
I don't have confidence
in that. If every person who votes, if as soon as you cast your vote, you get three receipts. You get one receipt that you dropped in the box for the Democrats, one receipt that you dropped in the box for the Republicans, and one receipt that you dropped in the box for the Independents, and one receipt that you dropped in the box for the local election commission, then every one of those boxes should have the same amount of votes. And it should be a lockbox, and it should be picked up by each one of those parties. One party should not have a Democrat winning and another box have a Republican winning. They should all agree because they should all come from four-part receipts. That is the only way, and it's a very simple way, to keep our voting clear of corruption. But it will never be done because I believe that this whole idea of a two-party system is a fallacy anyway. I think they get together and decide who's going to be in office. But they took voting out of the hands of American people when they got rid of paper receipts.
I just think myself, I just don't think that there's any accurate way for any votes because everything is so divided and crooked in this. There's too much corruption in the country to even think about whether it be votes or anything else. And
well,
like I said,
what would you doubt about that way? What would make you doubt that that wouldn't work? Assuming that the Democrats wanted their candidate to win, the Republicans want their candidate to win, the Independents want their candidate to win, and the local election commission wants their election to be fair and honest. If they had four-party receipts, what could go wrong with that?
Nothing really. I mean, it would be more monitored.
So I'm saying, and it would be very cheap. It would be very cheap. All we're talking about is a little ticker tape, a little voting paper. To give them receipts. The individual voter would definitely want their votes to be the ones that they cast, and they would have a chance right away to see whether or not it was the person they voted for. It wouldn't be left in the machine for them to print out at the end of the night. You can change a number with a stroke of a key tab. So, you know, I mean, when we hear about all this corruption with the computers, why would we leave something as important as voting up to computers? It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So it shows that Americans are not thinking. I know what they do to computers because they do it to my computer. Why would you leave voting up to a computer when it's very simple for anyone, not necessarily someone in the local voting commission? It's possible for any hacker to hack into that voting computer that's sitting in Georgia in a small town if they want to. Anything that's on computer is hackable. So understand that, and you shouldn't leave it up to computerized voting. You should demand, you being all voters, should demand a paper receipt. And they should have some way to put the paper receipt somewhere that it could be eligible for recount. So thank you very much.
I just think the government themselves, I mean, we're talking about people that are running the country that have no idea what the American people, the average American people, their needs are. They don't have any idea at all. Even if they try to do the right thing, they're not capable of doing it. They just don't know. People who have come from the similar backgrounds of the people they're leading, or people that come from the cultures, I don't know what it is, but it's whether it be whatever. President Obama, he came from a very affluent area. I mean, he grew up with some wealth, or some advantages. People that run the country need to be able to, they need to be able to know what the average American citizen goes through. And even if we voted or resolved that issue, we still have to deal with a government that does not know what the how to deal with the needs. And as a result, they're going to just do the easiest thing they can. They're going to throw people in prison. They're going to lock the key or throw away the key, and they're going to figure eventually we'll run out of these people and we don't have to worry about crime anymore. What they don't realize is babies are being born every day. Children are being taken, brought up without their fathers and mothers, and they're angry. And we have a mental an issue of mental illnesses and substance abuses, drug abuses. And our government is not, a lot of times, too, we have to remember, there's a lot of people in politics today that are also addicted. And that's why so much of it's being made, legalized? Because this way, as long as it's legalized, if they get caught, they don't have to worry about getting into trouble because they legalized it. So we have a problem in this country, and no matter who we vote in to become president, we have to deal with the substance abuse issues that they're going through, that they're involved in, and we've got to deal with the issues of not knowing how to deal with the people they're leading because they don't have the same issues. They're not familiar with the issues.
Well, I don't mean to cut you off, but the police chief here in 87 was arrested for taking drugs off the evidence room and became a millionaire on a lottery ticket a year ago, but supposed to be doing well. And if you're talking about testing policing and nurses and firemen, you know, test them, you know, drug test them and see if
that's
they're doing it. You know,
exactly.
And let alone there's people at the State House who died from drunk driving incidents who worked as aides to senators and government officials here in Massachusetts just from drunk driving. And legalizing marijuana doesn't do any good because I think the traffic tickets are going to go up. People are not going to have a car to drive once they get a ticket under the influence. And then they're going to lose their job and crime is going to go up. Because they got a quarry, first of all. Some people won't give you a driving job if you got one violation for drunk driving of a sort. And there's been people who advocated for the quarry law, you know. There was one woman whose son had his life together, and they did a background check. He had an apartment, a car. He was doing so well until they did a background. The kid ended up killing himself. Yeah, that, fine and well. But, you know, what about everybody else that's black? I speak at the detox, like I said, twice a month. You know who they're giving a chance to detox? The minorities, not the blacks. The blacks are going to jail for crimes and for drug offenses, and the whites are getting the detox and treatment. You know, I speak at the detox for over 3 or 4 years now. There's one or two blacks out of 60 in the room who may be volunteers or somebody Section 35 in there, where they need possibly help if they get help afterwards at all. And it's a sad case. And when I go, I'm like, why am I in a room full of all whites when that sounds like my trial? You know, when I was wrongly convicted, I had an all-white jury. And the black judge was the one who's still there that sent another guy to jail for something he didn't do. Who was white, you know, who spent 10 years for raping and commit. And when he finally got paid, he was the most that got paid across the state, $13.6 million. And he was in intensive care unit from an overdose of Percocet with $13.6 million out of the town of Marlborough, Massachusetts. So, it's a tough battle between, you know, who's going to be sober once they get the job or get in an apartment. You know, and like these elderly high-rises, I seen a story on this where the young are diagnosed with bipolar and schizophrenia and depression, but never treated for the drug addiction. And then once they dress up for an interview to get the apartment or a job, then all hell breaks loose once somebody come by and say, well, let's do this again, let's do that again, referring to drugs or alcohol. And what happens to them? They end up homeless and in the street. Because they don't pay their rent once they get a hold of the drugs and alcohol. They don't pay their light bill, their phone, they end up getting kicked out because the crowd, they bring in those high rises, you know, and it's gone like that for a long time. And
so many issues.
You know, Barack Obama could do so much, being one of the only few blacks in the White House, and Governor Patrick, the same case there. I understand why Deval Patrick supported Barack Obama, not because he's black, because Deval Patrick got a daughter who's gay, and Barack Obama was supporting gay rights, maybe not just for the votes, but they're not going to do it all. And Deval Patrick can do so much himself without them talking about him. You know, and every week in the back of the Boston Herald, they make Barack Obama look like a monkey. They give him big ears and big lips, even in today's paper. You know, and I can't stand to read it. You know, if I read anything, it's just a horoscope. But to watch what they do to Barack Obama, and they talk about him after they talk about crimes on Channel 7, you know, black-on-black crimes or black to this or black to that, then Barack Obama's name come up. I'm so sick of it. And the weatherman is like the sweetest guy ever, you know, on the radio, on the TV. So I don't even watch TV. My TV ain't been on the past 2 hours, you know, because I know what's coming on next. You know, and give the black heroes credit in the service, in the war. They're doing the same thing they did years ago. They're not showing them come home for celebrations with their kids, surprising their wife, surprising the kids at the daycares, at the schools. And they're not showing that. You know, you don't see it. You know, and someone had a comment and said, well, blacks don't want nothing to do with their families. That's not true. There are black soldiers, husband and wife, in the war who are together trying to make a living.
Yeah.
You know, and they don't let it show a black soldier surprising his wife, even Valentine's. There's no blacks in the paper Thanksgiving, Christmas. I get very upset because I have to go. I want to read a paper, and relax and enjoy a coffee. Can't do that well. See, it's something I can identify with, you know. It's a big identity crisis. You know?
It is.
Racism, no one can say racism don't exist. It's still here. You know, as long as those people are in power, it's never going to change. You know, like the basketball owner, the team owner. And I see it every day at the coffee shops. I see it at the meetings I go to. You know, they don't want to shake your hand. They don't want to look at you twice. If they're lucky they see you 2 minutes, that's enough for them for the day. And they go on about their business, you know, and don't care a bit about you. I live a life around.
Well, you know, racism is absolutely one of the biggest problems that we face in America. It's much bigger than I thought it was. Racism is prevalent throughout the justice system. So anytime you talk about justice system, you're talking about a war on blacks. And so that is what's happening. And not only in the justice system, but also in just about every area of government in America, we're facing a great deal of racism. And the darker complexion a person is, the more racism they will face. For instance, I'm told that, and I didn't hear it, but I was told that during the president's recent speech, he made promises regarding Latinos. But, again, he did not mention any promises for change regarding blacks. Now, I didn't hear his speech, but that would be typical of what I would expect because racism is very prevalent throughout America from the top down. And I want you to know that racism is not just something that whites can feel toward blacks, but it's also something that blacks can feel toward blacks. Because there's a tendency to dump on whoever is disenfranchised. Whoever is the easiest victim would be the person who would be most victimized. And that is why racism usually targets people who are black. Because in America, the blacker you are, the more disenfranchised you are, because you may he's still suffering from a lack of wealth due to the racist practices of America over the last number of years, even since slavery. But even during slavery, we had a great number, more than you would expect, of black slave owners who were also capitalizing off the enslavement of Africans in America. Starting beyond that, if you go to Africa, you will see that those countries where Africans came from over here to be slaves sold them. And so, you know, it's wrong to just start the conversation about racism here in America. The conversation about racism starts in Africa, where individuals, certain individuals, actually sold their black brothers and sisters into slavery. So black-on-black crime is not a recent development. It's something that started maybe, you know, 500 years ago in Africa. So we have to, I just don't start anything in the middle. You know, you start discussing problems at the beginning of them. So the beginning of enslavement of black people was an African development. It started in Africa.
I want to say something about that because when I was in Africa, one of the things is, you're right, Mary, you know, the lighter you are in Africa, the better you're treated, because there was a case where there was a white lady in a store where I was, and I noticed how she talked to them, how she talked to the cashier, and I spoke up. I had to say something to her, and she didn't say anything to me because she saw that she could tell I was an American. But one of the things that the Africans over in, especially where I was at the time in Ghana, I asked the young man why he let her speak to him the way she did, because it wasn't called for. But he didn't, it's almost like it was a sign of respect for her. But one of the things is the Ghanaians over there, they themselves said about the Americans, the African Americans, they said a lot of them, when they go over to those countries, and not all of them, because there's some that go over all the time. They're very close to the brothers and sisters there. But they said that the African Americans from America, they go over to Ghana or any country in Africa, and they go to the tourist attractions. They act like, and this is what they themselves said, they act like the rich white man. They go over, they enjoy themselves in the tourist attractions, they spend their money, and then they come back to America. They said they never even try, a lot of them never even try to learn about their roots. They don't go to the villages, and they don't go to these places where there's no water, electricity, and food, and, I mean, lighting and everything. They just go, and so, and even in America, the lighter a person is, even sometimes, that not that light African American, but the person, another African American that's darker, is going to turn, or they're not going to respect or have anything to do with that African American that's lighter, because they feel the darker you are, the more you're accepted by them. So it goes both ways, and this is a major problem, because we've been taught throughout the years to divide ourselves from each other. And this is what's been happening throughout these years, is that everybody, a lot of people, are so ashamed of their own race, their own culture, their own skin, that they can't come together in the right way. And how can you fight against racism when we're a part of it within our own cultures? And Phil Donahue one time said that when he had an all-black show, and he had a couple of sisters that were on there who were very light-complected. They said that their mother and father, they traced themselves back, and there was no, they could never saw anything about any white being in their family. So they were completely African-Americans, but yet they were almost white. They looked white. And it started out like a peaceful conversation, them everybody talking, and something happened where they all started going off on one another. He couldn't shut them up. And he turned around and he says, how can you expect the white man to show respect for you when you can't show respect for one another? And that's what it is in this country.
Yeah,
and I want to say this too, Pete, real quickly. Even with the Cape Verdeans, the Hispanics, the Chinese, the Asians, all of them, if they were to acknowledge the fact that they're all people of color and take it from there, and maybe they'd see changes. But again, everybody wants to separate themselves from each other because they don't want to accept the fact that they are of color. And our politicians in the United States, the black politicians, and I don't care which one it is, black politicians are black politicians, they themselves feel like they're white because their peers treat them really nice, and they think it's because they like them no matter what. They think it's because they consider them like their own. But they have to accept them. The politicians, the white politicians in America, they have to accept the black politicians because they're all working together. But it doesn't mean that that gives our politicians of color the go-ahead to say, well, you know, we're different from the blacks because, you know, we're accepted by our peers. And their peers are the people that are in the White House with them or in the State House with them. It's not even about we are accepted because we're black and they see us as white. They don't see anybody as white. But that's why I say we need to accept ourselves before we can expect the whites.
Right. It's up to the individual to grow and get out of the identity crisis and find out who they are before they point the finger at somebody else. I understand. Deval Patrick's not that guy, and neither is Barack Obama. And when Barack Obama was running, that issue came up, whether he's black or he's white and all that other stuff. So it's still plays. And I'm thinking, you know, how I grew up. I went to a busing all-white school in the 70s when the race riots were going on in Roxbury. And we had police escorts in front, on the side, and in the back of the bus. Well, they didn't want blacks there. Now the whole neighborhood mixed with Spanish of all kinds, blacks, and even Barack Obama's aunt was living in the projects in South Boston where they didn't want blacks, you know, during busing. And God rest her soul, right? She just passed. And, you know, I feel like the way I've been treated fairly over some that I don't know about by whites, even at the local coffee shop, has been great. Because if I ever need anything, like a job of a sort, I might get asked in that one. If I want to work with a bunch of whites, you know, but other than that, you know, it's up to the individual to grow and work in those places and say, well, I was one of them, but now I ain't forgot, and do some changes and start talking about the white and black race card, you know?
That's it.
It ain't about that. And let alone what's going on in Iraq.
You're so right, Peter. It's not about black and white. It's time for everybody it's time for all working class and indigent people. Everybody who's working class and poor, it's time for us to drop racism, prejudice, and get together and work for justice. Because I want you to know that what they started out just doing to black people, shooting down our relatives, shooting down especially the ones who are mentally ill, they have started doing to Latinos and whites the same thing, shooting down even healthy whites. For no reason. Just last year, a young man who was about to graduate from college, high in his class, I think he had an almost 4.0 grade point average in Texas. A police shot him down because he said he was belligerent with him. So these things are happening no longer just to blacks, but they're happening increasingly, all Caucasians. So it's time for everybody to lay aside racial prejudice and work together for justice, because really it's these crimes against humanity are happening across the board to anyone who is in the working class or poor.
Yeah. And the sad thing is the police, it's the law enforcement. They're the ones, they've gotten to the point now where they know they can get away with so much because no one's doing anything about it. And like you say, the U.S. Department of Justice, they need to get more involved. And I'm not saying they're right, because I think they're very wrong. And I'm one, every time I send anything out in my emails pertaining to any abuses, I have their email. I send it. I have three names in the U.S. Department of Justice, and I send it out to all three of them every time. I've asked the advocates Not that I'm telling advocates how to do their business, but I've mentioned to the advocates that's the one way, that's the one thing we need to do. We need to get these things out. Every time you email something within the network, send it out to them as well. People, one of the things that bothers me the most is that we get things from the advocates, from a lot of advocates. It's like they don't know who to do what with, so they're sending it around to each other. So it's going around like a yo-yo, and nothing's being done. It's not getting to the right sources. And I say, if you're going to send things around, send it around to everybody, not just the advocates themselves, but send it around to the media. Send it around. I mean, the government has addresses. They have addresses where you can write to them. You know, they have telephone numbers where you can call them. All these things can be done. And sometimes when I mention this to advocates, they get upset. They get upset with me because I'm trying to be somebody that I'm not. I don't know. And Donna Fender, she comes out, Donna Hill, she comes out with this remark about, you know, New Vision's not even known. I know somebody on Cape Cod, in Massachusetts that had never even heard of New Vision, which is a lie. But what does that have to do with it? I could care if people know about us or not. And Bill can tell you. You can tell Mary, everybody, that we've been out there for a long time.
Yeah.
We got accommodations, commendations. I have not even shown people.
You did a lot of good for a lot of people, and the people that are listening should take heed if they're in any situation or on their way to any, like I've been. And some of the people today don't know they're building prisons that are industries that are built to make money. It wasn't long ago that Deval Patrick mentioned about building a jail for senior citizens. And, you know, because the senior citizen maybe sometimes breaking the law and selling their prescriptions, you know, and to make money, to get by. And there's a lot of things they might do that according to breaking the law. But, you know, even the elderly are getting abused in prison. You know, their canteens being stolen, the young guys taking advantage of their cookies or their snacks or the deodorant. There's things that are going on in jail where a click might be waiting for someone just to come in like that. They might think have a lot of money. Or even a Social Security check that they know they're going to get canteen and rob them when they get it, you know. And, you know, they take a blind eye to it. The disabled, the mentally ill getting abused, they're not telling the courts or they're not telling the House of Corrections they have a mental illness. They don't know, you know.
No, and they're not treating them anyway. But Deval Patrick shouldn't be looking at building senior citizens' prisons. What Deval Patrick needs to do is start looking at the compassionate releases. I mean, like you say, these people are old. A lot of them are helpless. And a lot of them are being mistreated in the prisons. And yet they're talking about building more prisons. What's the sense of building more prisons for the elderly? If you know, I want to say with the juveniles, they're talking about juveniles that have committed crimes. They weren't mature enough to be able to discern the difference between right and wrong, and I have to disagree with that because juveniles today they can distinguish the difference between right and wrong. Maybe they don't have role models, which I'm adamant about, but they can distinguish right from wrong. The problem
I don't want to cut you off. They don't have the mental capacity not to commit the crime, the education not to commit the crime, and they do it out of compulsion, you know, a quickness to make fast money, or whether it's to murder or to rob, you know.
I just want to interject one thing that we haven't talked about. I'll just say the words. It comes down to prison profiteering, why people are not interested in compassionate release. It comes down to the prison profits. Prisons have become one of America's biggest growth industries. We have 60 seconds until the end of the show, Leona.
Okay, real quickly, Pete, you don't have an email address, so it's difficult for anyone to get in touch with you.
Yeah, this number's fine.
You want to give your telephone number, and in case anyone wants to participate in joining you and trying to do something about it, maybe going to the universities or whatever.
Yes.
Okay. give your telephone number and any of your contact information.
Yes, I'm Peter Vaughn, Rockland, Massachusetts. My phone number is 508-468-1922. 1922, 508-468-1922. Any hour, day or night, it's okay to call.
And
I'm going to send you a picture, and I appreciate you having me on your show.
And we'll get that out, and Mary may maybe be able to help us to get that out there on the Internet for the wrongfully convicted.
Yeah, Mary, full of information. I like what I heard. I took the time out to recharge my phone while I was listening to the whole show. So.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.
How you doing?
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Liana.
Okay, and anyone that wants to do some, we have a new director of the letter writing campaign. Her name is Chatham Dilshara, and she is going to be doing the letter writing campaign for all the abuse. So if anybody wants to be a part of it, contact us at where we have a place where you can write at. The website is www.nvoinc.org, and they can actually apply to send a letter, and she will respond to them. Mary, thank you so much. Bill, I want to talk with you more about your recent conversation. Mary, I want to thank you again, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Human Rights Demand, New Vision Organization. See you again next Monday. Bye.